Meeting of the House Civil Law Committee. Actually, we can't call it to order yet. So we don't have a quorum, so we're not going to call it to order. We need one more person. But until we have that, we can call it to order and move the minutes. Until we have that, we do have some judges who have been gracious enough to join us here today. I asked Judge Warner, who's the Chief Judge of the 2nd Judicial District, Ramsey County, to see what she could do about explaining items regarding the civil process to us on the committee. Many of new members, not just the new members, but also returning members, are not completely familiar with all the different components of the civil process in the state of Minnesota. There are many different factors to it, things that we have to consider before the committee. So, Judge Warner, would you be willing to join us at the podium?
Mr. Chair, if I may bring Judge Vandeville and Judge Dorfman.
Absolutely. If we wanted to do it at the same time, that would be great.
Thank you,
Your Honor. And if each of you, before you speak, could please, as I'm sure you're familiar with telling people, state your name for the record so we have it. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the Civil Law Committee, again, thank you for having us here this morning. My name is Tracy Warner. I'm a district court judge in Ramsey County, which is the 2nd Judicial District here in the state. I do serve as Chief Judge of the District, and it's an honor and a privilege to be here today. I know Chairman Lesh in his work as a St. Paul City Attorney, but as a legislator, I'm not in his district, but I grew up on the east side of St. Paul, so I have some pretty deep roots, and I know Mr. Chair
on the grumpy old men block, in fact, I think.
You're familiar with my roots, yes. Mm. But it's an honor, and it is a privilege to be here to talk a little bit about the civil law process, hopefully answer any questions that you have. With me today is Judge Louise Bjorkman from the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Judge Bjorkman chaired the Civil Justice Reform Task Force. It was a Supreme Court committee that looked at the civil process in the state and recently made recommendations to the Supreme Court. I thought Judge Bjorkman would be great to talk about some of what the task force looked at. To my left is Judge Jack Vandenorth, my colleague in St. Paul. Judge Vandenorth has been the lead judge in our civil division in the 2nd District. We're completely blocked in the 2nd District. The judge is in one particular assignment. Judge Vandenorth has been the lead judge in our civil assignment for just about 4 years. So he's doing this every day. And I thought, again, the three of us hopefully will be able to give you a decent presentation, but be able to answer your questions as well. Just as a side note, Judge Vandenorth, Judge Bjorkman, and I all started within about 11 months. And we've been friends. We came to the judicial branch together and developed a friendship in working as judges. Judge Bjorkman took a little break and went into private practice, but again, the civil practice of law. So it's nice to be here, too, with two of my colleagues, but two of my friends. So I'd like to get started, Mr. Chair, if that's okay, in the presentation.
Your Honor, if right before you get started, if we could, members, we now have a quorum, so I would like to call the meeting to order. With members, I know having had the extra time to review the minutes, I'd ask for a motion.
So moved.
The minutes have been moved. All in favor of the minutes as stated, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Motion passes. Thank you. Judge Warner, please continue.
All right. I want to be respectful of your time, so I'll roll right into my presentation. And please, if you have questions, Mr. Chair, if it's okay with you, I'd be happy to entertain them as we go along.
Absolutely. Thank you. We will do that. So, members, if you have questions during the course of the presentation, please signal staff, and we'll interrupt the presenters. Thank you, Judge Warner. Please proceed.
Thank you. I'd like to start. My first slide indicates what we do as district court judges. There's 289 district court judges in the state. We're made up of 10 judicial districts. Each judicial district encompasses a number of counties, with the exception of Ramsey County, which is the 2nd judicial district. Hennepin County is the 4th judicial district. The other 8 judicial districts make up multiple counties. We handle between 1.5 and 2 million cases a year. And there's basically five areas, civil actions, and that's what we'll be talking about in a little bit more detail, criminal, family, juvenile, and probate. Violations of city ordinances are either civil or criminal. Appeals for reconciliation court may consider civil actions. Civil disputes of up to $10,000 now are or may be handled in conciliation court. Conciliation court, civil disputes are up to $10,000. I believe that was a change from last year. And as I understand it, there's going to be a graduated increase up to $15,000. The Conciliation Court Division will handle civil disputes. Currently, I believe it's $10,000, and it will be up to $15,000 soon.
Judge Warner, I'm going to interrupt you for a second. What does it cost to file a Conciliation Court claim now versus filing a District Court civil law claim?
Judge Vandenhorst?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think it's $100 to file in conciliation court. It's about $325 or so in district court. So there's clearly an incentive to bring your claim in conciliation court if it fits the jurisdictional limit.
Thank you, Judge Vandenhorst. Oh, yes, go ahead, Rob Ripson-Hillstrom.
Thank you. So maybe you're going to get to this later on in your presentation, but do we have any information about whether or not that has been successful to go up to that $15,000 before we keep going higher, or can someone get us that later?
Judge Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe the numbers will show that it is a benefit. The conciliation process is a little different, too. In many judicial districts, referees handle conciliation court disputes. Hennepin, Ramsey, I know they have some referees in the first district as well. I think the third was also trying this, where they have somebody other than a district court judge initially. There's a statute, and I can't think of what it is for. I can't quote the statute, but it authorizes referees to hear conciliation court disputes. The reason I bring that up is you get into court quicker. Your dispute is heard more timely, sometimes at a conciliation court level. So, Representative Hillstrom, I believe the numbers will show that it's a benefit. I've got statistics on major and minor civil filings that I'll show you later. The numbers are going up, but I think ultimately it's a benefit to the citizens. In 2011, major case filings got on this chart. I think the important thing here is to indicate that criminal and juvenile make up approximately half of the major case filings at the district court level. The juvenile area includes both delinquency, which is criminal, and CHIPS. We call it CHIPS, which is children in need of protection or services. That's a civil process. But juvenile, the 21.1%, almost 43,000 cases include both major delinquency and child in need of protection or service cases. This just indicates, and I believe this information is that you have, just indicates major case filings in the last 10 years. Criminal is leveling off after an increase. Civil is increasing. We'll talk about that in a little bit. Juvenile filings are decreasing. I read a report last night about a program that's been started in many jurisdictions. It's called the Juvenile Detention Alternative Initiative, JDAI, Juvenile Detention Alternative Initiative. And what it is it's looking at alternatives to incarcerating our children, looking at alternatives to prosecuting low-level disorderly conducts, fifth-degree assaults. It's getting services to these kids as opposed to getting them in the juvenile justice system, and I think that's part of the reason for the juvenile to be decreasing. Regarding major civil filings, major civil filings in 2011, just over 40,000. Contracts and harassments make up about half of the major civil filings. Judge Vandenorth is going to talk in a little bit more detail about the types of cases of what contracts means. Harassments are, again, civil proceedings. It's one party. You know, you've heard harassment restraining order language. That's what a harassment is. It's a process. We handle it in Ramsey County in the 2nd Judicial District in our juvenile and family area, but it's a civil process where one party can get a restraining order, basically, against another party. This just shows over the 10-year period, major civil filings are down just a hair about 1,500 is the number in major civil filings. The next slide, this talks about civil filings. Mr. Chair, if I may refer to Representative Hillstrom's question before, this gets us to a breakdown of some of the specifics in the particular areas, shows the difference from 2006 to 2011. As you'll note, there's about a 42% increase over this five-year period, an increase in contract-type cases, 32% in judgments. Other civil is 24% of an increase. There is a decrease in basically the all the other areas of cases and civil filings. In working with Janet Marshall and working with members of the judicial branch, we think that the reason for the increase in these areas with contracts and judgments is due to the recession. It's also due to credit-related cases. We haven't done a thorough scientific study, but based on the numbers, that's what we assume.
Thank you, Judge. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you just clarify what's in judgments?
Well, we had a discussion about that. It's a pretty general category. Here's what I think a judgment is the enforcement of a judgment. If you sue me, you have to collect on that judgment, and that's that's certainly a piece of the judgment category. Judge Vandenorth.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, Tracy and I just talked about this yesterday afternoon. It's the first time I saw that category, so I'm not real sure what it encompasses, but I think Chief Warner's explanations probably make sense to me. It has to do with trying to enforce judgments and other matters relating to judgments already obtained, but it's a pretty big number, so... 44,000. Maybe Janet Marshall can help us later afterwards, but I'm not sure what it contains, to be honest. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Vandenorth. Judge Warner?
Mr. Chair, speaking with Judge Bjorkman, collections is a big piece of it, and that certainly is a big piece of what a judgment is the collection or enforcement of a judgment. So that is the bulk. And I mean, that would make sense. I mean, given the recession, it would make sense, I guess, as I think about it a little bit more, you know, you can obtain a judgment, but collecting on it is another step, is the second step.
So. Judge Warner, how many are you able to determine, based upon the number of judgments awarded, how many subsequent collections-related claims are out of that? If I sue someone, how likely are they to actually pay me versus me having to go and collect on a judgment?
It's a good question, and I think the 58,000 in 2011 reflects the bulk of exactly what you're speaking of, Mr. Chair, is the collection of those judgments. And you have to think about a judgment. You can get a judgment in conciliation court. I just signed off approving a referee's or a decision in a conciliation court. It was about a $1,300 property damage. One neighbor was doing something to their yard that caused some damage to their neighbor. It was about a $1,300 landscaping claim. Now, that plaintiff got a judgment against the defendant. But collection is a whole separate area. So you have to file, if you're going to file a the judgment, that's another civil action, separate. So that's exactly, you know, the filing. What are your chances of collecting? What revenue recapture? There's all sorts of remedies, but I think what's 58,000 from 180? Is it roughly a third? I mean, I think that's about a third of the judgments are go into a collections. Okay. I think that's about your figure, about 33%.
Thank you, Your Honor.
That's pretty rough. That's my Catholic school math. And that's no disrespect to Representative Yarusso, who taught at my alma mater. But I will indicate that I never took any of the classes that she taught because they were honors level and they were in the science. That was not my specialty. Anything else? I don't know if anybody else has any questions about this breakdown. I thought it was pretty telling, though, to look at where we have, I mean, a significant increase, contracts, judgments, and then the other civil overall. We talked about some consumer issues, some other types of cases that would fall into the other civil that I think are primarily related to the recession and credit-related issues. Just to balance our district court's numbers with the Court of Appeals. Court of Appeals filings for the year 2011 were approximately 2,200. Here's a chart that shows the types of cases that are getting filed at the Court of Appeals level. 32% criminal, 32% civil. So it's equal in the criminal and civil, balanced with the number of filings in district court. At our Supreme Court level for 2011, approximately 45% of all the cases that go to the Supreme Court are criminal in nature, but that civil, again, almost 35% compared to 32% at the Court of Appeals level.
Thank you, Judge Warner. Representative Liebling, do you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if it's so much a question, but sort of an observation, and maybe you'd like to sort of reflect on this, is that when we talk about percent change in filings, and as we look at these, you know, obviously a pie chart, we're not looking at change on this one, but I wonder if you've got any analysis or given thought to, when we're talking about the reason for the change in that table we were looking at for a while, that there could be a lot of forces going on there. And when we talk about, well, maybe it's the recession on the judgments piece, and maybe it is, but especially when we look at the criminal and juvenile, I wonder if you've done some analysis about how much simple population demographics are impacting that. So, for example, we know that the most crimes are committed by a certain age group of people. And as we have fewer people in that age group, naturally, we're going to have a decrease in crime if it's really related to that age group, which it seems to be. And certainly for juvenile, that's going to be true. If we have fewer juveniles, we're going to have a decrease, one presumes, in juvenile crime and in juvenile filings. So, you know, I think it's really valuable to see the change just in terms of how it impacts the courts. But I think it's hard to look at that and sort of think there's and surmise what the underlying process might be without more information about what's going on in the general population.
Thank you. That wasn't a question, is that right, Representative?
Well, Mr. Chair, I just wondered if they hadn't, since we were sort of discussing the reasons, I wondered if the judge wanted to kind of comment on that so that we sort of aren't left. I think it's easy to get a misimpression sometimes from this kind of data.
Judge Warner.
Representative Liebling, you're absolutely correct. These pie charts, these graphs, you know, are just a snapshot, absolutely. But a deeper analysis is necessary to answer the why question. The why question is the tough one. I'll speak to juvenile. I talked about JDAI. I read a report last night. I was studying some of the work in our juvenile area on a it's DMC, disproportionate minority incarcerations. That isn't the C word. I can't figure out what it is, but it has to do with the number of minority people we have, minority youth we have incarcerated in the juvenile system. And to your point, you're exactly right. The demographics are changing, and they do impact. I'll just speak in the Second Judicial District, talking about it by way of analogy, in our probation department, in the probation department in Ramsey County, 38 probation officers. That's the reduction, 38 in our juvenile system. Now, when I hear as a judge, we've got 38 probation officers in juvenile, I'm like, oh my gosh, that's terrible. But it's based on exactly what you're talking about, not only our programs, but on changing demographics. So there's a number of factors that come into play. I think you're right in the juvenile and criminal arenas. As it relates to civil, again, an in-depth analysis has to be made. We do that at the district court level all the time. Judge Vandenorf is going to touch on some of that. We're looking at, there's Supreme Court time-wise, there's Supreme Court guidelines for us to handle cases in a timely fashion, but you know, the demographics, the what's going on in the economy, what's going on in society certainly impacts, and a deeper analysis is necessary, and it's something that we do consider. Thank you for pointing that out. The last slide I have, if I may proceed, Mr. Chair?
Absolutely.
The last slide is just a very simple explanation of the civil case process. A civil action is commenced by the creation of a complaint. That complaint has to be served. An answer has to be provided. This chart just very simply goes through what the process is. The only thing I really want to point out, you have these materials, is the process concludes if it's not dismissed, if the process is successful, there's a judgment. And that's one of the categories that we were talking about before. If you're successful, you obtain a judgment, and I think that's even a default judgment. And I don't have the statistics on how many default cases there are. That's something I'd certainly be willing to obtain if anybody's interested, but the process does end in a judgment if successful, and then enforcement of that judgment is a separate proceeding.
Thank you, Judge Warner.
That's all I had.
One separate question related to the judgments. What are the various remedies for collecting on a judgment that you have in the civil system?
There's several, Judge Vandenorf.
Mr. Chairman,
members
of the committee, there's lots of rights that judgment creditors have. Some of those you're probably familiar with, garnishing wages, attaching bank accounts and assets. That's probably the more typical way that people go forward in trying to collect their judgments. Mr. Chairman, to answer to your question earlier, what are your chances of getting paid just by virtue of the fact of obtaining a judgment? I think it's less than 50-50 for sure, and I would guess that Judge Warner's estimate of about 30-35% is probably pretty accurate. Most of the activity in this area, as you know, is related to a credit card default, consumer credit defaults, which we handle so many of in the last few years, to the point where we've had to set up a separate calendar just for consumer credit problems. And I would say more than 70% of those matters that appear on our consumer credit docket go by default. Nobody shows up, or the judgment, or the debtor, the person in default, often shows up pro se. Unfortunately, they're often at a disadvantage. It's not a level playing field, as they take on the banks and the creditors who are often represented. Judges do what we can to, you know, level that playing field. We do what we can for folks, but the law is the law. At the end of the day, a defense that I need more time, I just don't have the money, I've always paid my debts, doesn't get you there. And a judgment is often entered against those folks, which they have a difficult time paying, and then we handle a lot of post-judgment remedy matters in court, dealing with garnishments, attachments, and so on, where folks again come into court and say, please don't garnish my wages. As you may know, there are some exemptions, but again, it's a very technical area in which people claiming exemptions are often outmatched by lawyers representing the judgment creditor.
Thank you, Judge Vandenorth. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, we're hearing a bill on that very subject at 2:15 today. If you have any input you'd like to give, we'd love to hear it.
Very good. Well, Representative Hillstrom and Chairman Lesch, you seem like you're keyed in on a couple of really timely and important matters. The rising level of conciliation court matters is due in part to collection efforts by banks and credit card companies and other creditors bringing these actions in conciliation court. They operate on volume, and of course one of the things they want to do is to minimize their filing fees. If you're doing thousands of these every year, the difference between 100 and 325 is a big number, and it may make your collection operation profitable or not. So we're seeing that uptick in conciliation court. One of the things to remember about conciliation court, it's really a type of alternative dispute resolution. It's not necessarily binding. Either party has an automatic right to remove the case to district court. And I don't have the breakdown here, but what we call conciliation court appeals or removals to district court from conciliation court are also up. So if you lose before the referee in conciliation court, you can go right to district court and have the matter reheard de novo, in other words, from scratch in district court. And the fact that you prevailed in conciliation court does not give you some preference or leg up in district court. So that's another area in which we see not only an increase in conciliation court in the first instance, but there's also more activity for us district court judges on appeals from conciliation court. But again, a lot of it's related to the economy.
Thank you, Judge Vandenorth. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So are you finding that as very many of the pro se people are actually taking it to district court, or is it more that the businesses lose in conciliation court and then they're appealing it to district court?
Judge Vandenorth.
Or is there a statistic on that? Judge Bjorkman may have found something here. She's done a lot on civil justice reform, so she may have some insight on that. Judge Bjorkman?
Judge Bjorkman.
All right, thank you. Chairman Lesch, in connection with our work, we looked at the appeals from conciliation court, and in 2010, there were an excess of 54,000 conciliation court filings, but only 780 went on to appeals in the district court. So what we have found is, for the most part, those cases begin and end in conciliation court.
So,
Representative Hillstrom.
Of those that are appealed, are they appealed by the pro se party more frequently, or are they appealed by the business who's lost to the pro se party in conciliation court? Do we have any way of knowing?
Yeah. Chairman, we don't have that data. It doesn't drill down that far. That would be interesting to find out.
Thank you.
Representative Hillstrom?
That's it, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Judge Vandenorth.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, just one last little piece on that. I was just asking Chief Warner whether she remembers, if you remove it to district court, you have to pay the full filing fee in order to start over in district court, and that's that $325, give or take. So that's a disincentive, and I'm surprised by that level of appeals that Justice Bjorkman has unearthed. I would have guessed, just looking at my own caseload, that we have more of those. But they're probably more, maybe, in the urban area than outstate, and we only have five judges handling them, so maybe it just seems like more. But that $325 removal fee may be a disincentive. And to answer your question, is it more, the kind of the business litigant or the pro se litigant? I see both. I'd say 50-50.
Okay. Representative Urso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is that filing fee something that can be waived for indigent parties?
Judge Warner?
I don't know.
Mr. Chair, Representative Urso, there's a process called an informa pauperis, and so a person can request that the filing fee be waived. It's based on the federal poverty guidelines, and so yes, there is a process by which the filing fee can be waived.
Thank you. Questions from other members of the committee? I had a question for any of the judges. I think when I had a rental property probably 13 years ago and was inexperienced as a landlord and ended up giving people too many opportunities to well, I'll pay next month. So I think I was owed probably a month and a half's worth of rent at that point till I finally said, okay, you need to get out of here. And I didn't even need to file an eviction action. I said leave, and they did end up leaving, which I suppose I should consider a good thing. But I did go into conciliation court and file, I think, whatever it was at the point, probably between $1,500 and $2,000 for some damages as well. And it was a situation like that where I was the only one who showed up. There was someone else from what must have been representing a lot of different landlords, suing a bunch of different tenants in there as an agent. I got my judgment, which I never followed up on, which I think must have expired, as I understand it, after about 10 years. Now, how many of those actually expire? And did that impact my former tenants in any way, insofar it was seen as an outstanding judgment on a credit report? Does that not happen unless it's a separate, you separately file it in a separate action? How does that work?
Well, Mr. Chairman, you're absolutely correct. Judgments are good for 10 years unless they're renewed, and they can be renewed for 10 years. Again, it's a cost-benefit analysis for the judgment creditor, whether they want to even try to collect on the judgment. Given the amount, they kind of do some initial investigation to see whether there's assets there to make it worth their while. But assuming it is worth their while to do some collection work, they'll do that. If it's a big judgment and they've had some success collecting, they might renew that judgment for 10 years. Again, I don't have any scientific data to answer your question with, but I would guess very few extend beyond 10 years. The fact that you have a UD or an eviction action on your record, my understanding is, anecdotally, it makes it more difficult for you to rent another property. It's something that's on your record, and in this very tight housing market in the Twin Cities, that is probably the worst thing that happens to you as a result of your eviction. Notwithstanding the fact you might be out in the street in cold weather, that's no fun. But trying to get a new place, if you've been found guilty of an unlawful detainer, that makes it harder for you to get a new place.
Thank you, judges. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to help you out on that, I don't know if you filed the unlawful detainer since they left on their own. You probably just filed a small claims action. And, you know, as a landlord, if you do your credit checks, you know, when the next renter comes in, you'll be able to see if there's a recent judgment or not. And obviously, if they fill out the application stuff, and you have the authority to check on their credit, and that'll show up too, obviously.
Well, this relates actually, Judge Vandernorth, to part of my other question. If I never file a separate action to record that judgment, do I need to record the judgment separately, or just by virtue of the fact that I was awarded a judgment in conciliation court, does that show up on a potential renter's credit report?
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Scott, my understanding is that you get a judgment in conciliation court. That's just like a judgment in district court, and it would appear on the court records, and anybody doing a judgment search would find it.
Okay, thank you. Questions from other members of the committee? Well, I wanted to thank Your Honors. Judge Warner?
Are we done, or do
you still have a few minutes? You still have time, yes, absolutely.
Judge Vandernorth, Mr. Chair, and Judge Bjorklund just have a few. I thought, Mr. Chair, it'd be helpful to hear from both Judge Vandenorth and Judge Bjorkman about the Reform Task Force, a little bit about their work. And Judge Vandenorth's 4 years of just civil work, I'd like him to just give you a bird's eye view of what he's been doing the last 4 years as it relates to the civil process.
We absolutely would like to hear from both of them. Thank you very much, Judge Warner. Judge Vandenorth?
Thank you, Chief. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thanks again for having us here today. And we know you're busy, and I will not repeat things we've already talked about, and I'll try to be efficient. One of the things that Judge Warner is going to say, I think at the end here, is he's going to invite all of you to do what we call a ride-along. And I know you're busy, and you're going to get busier as the session goes on. But if you had a half a day, or even part of a day, and you'd like to come down and sit in my courtroom, or you can sit up on the bench with me if you want, and see what it's like live, I brought some cards along. So afterwards, if anybody wants a card, this will give you a phone number and a email address. You just contact me, and my law clerk and your staff can get together, and I would love to have you come down and see what it's actually like in our courtroom handling civil cases. I've been on the bench 15 years, just like my colleagues up here. And all of us, especially Louise and I, come from a civil background. We were both in private practice for, in my case, about 25 years before I went on the bench. So I've been doing this kind of work for a long time. And I've seen these changes over time. And I guess if I were going to identify one really significant change over time that I'm seeing more and more, is that with the advent of more and more technology, there is such an information explosion, and there's so much data available to lawyers on almost immediate basis that the papers we get in matters involving the most important issues in our community are getting more and more sophisticated and more detailed. So this is what I call sort of the, I guess, kind of the conundrum of increased technology. It provides lots of opportunities, of course, and we're using it in every way we can to be more efficient, more productive, to stick within the Supreme Court guidelines for processing cases, which, by the way, in civil, is in the door, out of the door within 1 year. And we're definitely doing that. Pretty much on a statewide basis. We're certainly doing it in the second and third districts, which is Ramsey County and Hennepin County. So we're working more efficiently, more productively, but the challenge of this technology is to deal with all this data. And I bring along, just by happenstance, at 11 o'clock today, I have summary judgment and motions to dismiss in a malpractice case. And this is fairly standard. That's about the amount of paper that I would get in conjunction with these kinds of motions. And I wish it were my only one. We get a lot of these. And so this means that I have to try to digest all this, read it all, before my motion at 11 o'clock today. Now, I've had this for a while, so I haven't waited until 10 o'clock. And I have read it. But the reason I bring it up is this is a big deal. If these are dispositive motions today, after today this case could be gone for the plaintiff in this case who claims he suffered a brain injury because of post-operative medication problems. He's suffering some terrible consequences of that. The physicians and the nurses and the hospitals involved on the other side, of course, equally have an awful lot at stake in terms of their reputation in the community. I guess I'm just saying this, I want to get this right. This is a big deal for these people on both sides. And these kinds of cases for us district judges are getting more and more complicated, more and more detailed. It used to be 10 years ago, maybe you'd have cases cited to you from Minnesota, four or five cases. Now, we get cases on each side from every jurisdiction in the country on the issue. The lawyers seem to be getting younger and smarter every day. So it's not like, especially on these complicated civil matters, one side outguns the other. Both sides have good guns. And so while the level of filings has sort of leveled off, the volume of filings has sort of leveled off, the message I'm bringing to you today is I think they're becoming more complex and a little bit more difficult in terms of level of detail for us to deal with. We handle the cases assigned to us. All of the judges in Ramsey County, for example, there are five of us assigned to civil. I'm the lead judge. We each carry a caseload of about 180 cases at any given point in time. And we get assigned to us on a random basis the cases as they're filed. As the chief, I don't get to pick and choose, oh, that looks like an interesting case, that malpractice case, I'll take that one. I get a malpractice case, and the next case I get is a fence dispute. The next case I get is a conciliation court appeal. They just roll out to us randomly, and we handle those cases as they come before us. And what does that mean? Well, Chief Warner showed you the process chart. They come in. We develop a scheduling order that sort of lays out how this case is going to go. Typically, there's going to be some discovery between the sides, and then at some point, we are going to have these, dispositive motions. More and more cases are decided at the dispositive motion stage because trials are extremely expensive and extremely costly. I call it trial by paper. More and more cases are decided at the dispositive motion stage in the proceeding. So we spend a great portion of our time dealing with motions, not so much time in trial. It's not like criminal. It's just the opposite in criminal. Everything is live on the bench. Civil, you're in your office reading briefs, researching, and writing. But let me tell you what else we do in addition to handling those 180 cases that we have at any given point in time. And by the way, that means we resolve, on average, about 30 cases a month. And Justice Bjorkman will tell you this, just when you get rid of that pile on this corner of your desk, another set comes in on this corner. So we do about 180 cases a year, and then we get another 180 cases coming in. We resolve our cases, on average, within 1 year. Other things that civil judges do, we do lots of other things. We handle murder cases, we handle sexual psychopath cases, just like the criminal judges. We never are able to escape that, even when we're on a civil rotation. We handle our probation violations, we do signing responsibilities, we have weekend duty and night phone duty. There's always a judge on duty 24/7 in Ramsey County and in every district. And then we all have our extra little jobs. One of my extra jobs is that along with Judge John Guthman, we are responsible for all the mesothelioma or asbestos-related living and wrongful death cases in the state of Minnesota. So we have 1,500 of those cases, and that we move those in and out on about the same basis. We push a certain number of those cases out each year through settlement primarily, and we get a number of new filings each year. But the total caseload has remained about 1,500 for, I'm sure, the last 10 years or so. And we have handled all these cases in the 2nd District for the last 19 years, I believe. So we all have these little additional duties as well. So that gives you a little bit of a sense of what the trial judges do in our district. One of the things,
Judge Vandenhorst, before you go on, about half the members of the committee here are from the 2nd or 4th District, where they have block systems. Now, I'm not sure if Anoka County has a block system or if they have Hillstrom. Regardless, can you, for those that aren't, for those that live in areas of the state where you've got one judge on the bench in one county or whatever, how is your block system different from those other areas of the state?
Mr. Chairman, that's a really good question. And again, that's something Judge Warner and I were just discussing yesterday. Pretty much the Supreme Court says to the districts around the state, we don't care how you reach these standards, we just want you to reach these standards. In other words, civil cases, we want you to get these things resolved within a year. We want you to have certain clearance rates, and the Supreme Court has set those standards. And districts do it differently. We have, as Chairman Lesh has mentioned, what we call the block system. That means that I'm on civil generally for about 3 years, maybe a little more, and then I move to criminal, and I'll be on criminal, and all I'll do essentially or primarily is criminal for 3 years. Then I'll move from that to what we call our family juvenile rotation. Judge Warner told you what's involved with all of that. I'll do that for 3 years, and then I might rotate to, we have sort of a catch-all assignment that includes commitments and probate and matters like that. We have basically four rotations, but we are blocked to a certain type of case almost exclusively. We think it works great in Ramsey County. We've had that in place the whole time I've been there. There's always talk about tweaking it. I think we're always open to tweaking it to try to do it better. Other districts do it differently. For example, I know the first does it differently. Hennepin County has a little bit of a modification on what we do. And so there are a lot of ways of doing this. We think in the second this works well for us, we would export it to other districts if we were allowed to do that, because we think it's a really good way for judges to really learn an area, get really into the details before they move into another area, rather than trying to handle a trust dispute at 9 o'clock, a child custody matter at 11 o'clock, a malpractice case at 1:30, and conciliation court appeal at 3. Changing gears that often, to my way of thinking, is not the way to do it. I like the way we do it.
Thank you, Judge. Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and whoever wants to take this. I believe Dakota County uses a block system, but within that, I watched a child support case that took nearly a year to resolve, and four different visits and four different judges. And as I watched this process as an observer, it was wasted a lot of time. So, you know, you say that each district can determine their individual processes and procedures, but shouldn't there be some type of oversight in that if a particular county finds something efficient and a better use of not only taxpayers' dollars, but people's time, they're paying attorneys, et cetera. I mean, the thought that four different judges looked at this case over, actually took more than a year to get it resolved. It just seemed like everybody was wasting time and money, and I don't know if you do that in Ramsey County where you get the judge of the day when you show up, or if it's a case that you follow through it to conclusion so you don't have to reiterate everything. And you lose things in the process when you talk to four different judges over the course of more than a year.
Judge Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Holberg, you're right. I'm familiar how Dakota County does things. When we prepared we used the Dakota County model in our juvenile system for templates for orders. Dakota County was giving orders to families, to juveniles, to the parents, right in court. We didn't have that model, so I spent some time studying that model in Dakota County, probably 12 years now, and then we integrated that, or they exported it to us, and we borrowed it and developed our process based on what Dakota County is doing. Judge Vandenorth summarized the block system from the judge's perspective, but there's also the block system benefits from the family's perspective. We think it's a benefit to the families to have one judge. In fact, Judge Bjorkman, Judge Vandenorth, and I have all served in our family juvenile division where we have a project called One Judge, One Family. If you have a kid who's in detention on a delinquency matter, but you've got a family going through a divorce, and you might have a child protect CHIPS matter, we maintain that Dakota County, based on their system and based on their analysis, chooses to do things differently. That's their administration. That's how they choose to operate in St. Paul, based on the volume that we deal with, based on a number of factors. We feel that the block system benefits the judges, but it benefits people in our community, and that's why we do that. I think the system in Dakota County is different, and like your example of four different judges on the case, That's how they choose to do it. I work a lot with Judge Ed Lynch, who's the chief judge. We're constantly looking at systems. In fact, I spent many hours with Judge Cahill, who's the chief in Hennepin County, looking at systems. How are we best going to handle the cases, not only for us to meet those guidelines that Judge Vandenwerth was talking about, but also to serve the needs of the people in the system. So your example is one that perhaps isn't as efficient as it could be, but yet, you know, those judges in Dakota County, there's a couple of team approaches, so the same judges are working together on cases. So you may get multiple judges, but they do team the cases. Again, from an administrative standpoint, they feel it's efficient, but they're constantly looking at how to better the system.
But, Mr. Chair, if I might, where are the checks and balances within the system? Are you saying each court does pretty much what they want if they hit the year for on average for their civil cases, we're good to go? Or, I mean, as a again, an observer in this process, I thought that it was very confusing. I just don't think it was a good way to run a business, if you will. So at what point does somebody step in and say, hey, you know, we like you to have autonomy here, but we also have a responsibility to the taxpayers and the system and making sure we have a good product here, and we are concerned that your system or procedure is falling outside of the goals for the serving the residents of the state of Minnesota. I mean, who's the cop of the system, or how does that happen?
Judge Warner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, I think. That's a tough question. It's a tough question, Representative Colbert. In a sense, we police ourselves, okay? And when I say it's based on statistics, it's based on numbers, yeah, ultimately we have to fall within those guidelines. But are we serving, for instance, you know, you talk about a family, a CHIMS matter. We keep track, this is kind of a good segue into Judge Bjorkman and the Civil Justice Reform Task Force, because they looked at, numbers don't tell the true story, but you know, in the Second Judicial District, our time to permanency for kids in CHIPS cases was outside those guidelines. So internally, yes, through the judicial branch, through our police is administration, it's the judicial council, we're constantly looking at those numbers, we're looking at how these cases are being processed, because ultimately, processing gets us to how we're dealing with people. And we've been working very diligently in the second district to improve our numbers on this time to permanency. Okay, improve our numbers on time to permanency means we're getting kids adopted sooner. That's what it means. So I talk in terms of numbers, I talk in terms of timelines, but ultimately what that is that's about the people. So who's the cop? We're our own cops, I guess. And ultimately, when you talk about the judicial branch, ultimately it's the electorate, potentially. But we have to handle those cases under these guidelines, under these models. Is Dakota County meeting the timelines? Perhaps. Is that case meeting the timelines? But then you have to look at what's happened. Is there recidivism rates? You know, I'm getting way beyond your question. But if these kids, if there's recidivism, then we know the system isn't working. Is it based on numbers? Ultimately, yes, but it's based on what's happening to the people in the system.
Right.
So then changes are made. But that's how we look at it, are the numbers.
But
okay.
And Mr. Well, but in this case, there was a support system here that this individual didn't have to go on assistance or anything in order to put food on the table, but somebody in another situation to wait, what I believe actually it was over a year, to have some kind of resolution, and that person may have had to have relied on the taxpayers, right, for support while they were waiting for this process to unfold. And
Understood. Members, we do have Representative Simon, Representative Hillstrom has questions too, and I want to be respectful of the judge's time. So some of these questions are more broader that we can address as issues come before us for the remainder of the session, and also if members could turn off their cell phones. Your Honors, that's a cell phone issue we have here. We understand you're short on budget in the judiciary, too. We can't even pay for decent microphones in here. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks to all three of you for coming here. And on the civil justice reform piece, congratulations on a great product, I think, after a long time. In my other life, I practiced civil litigation. I'm involved with the MSBA civil litigation section, so congratulations on that. But I just have a couple questions. Judge Vandenorth, it was a vivid reminder when you showed people all the paper that gets generated in these cases, especially the complex civil cases. And I'm wondering whether you see a trend towards farming out to special masters or others some of kind of the paper policing when it comes to discovery, particularly in some of these larger cases. Do you see that trend? Is that a good thing? Should we be doing more of that, less of that? What do you think?
Was that for Judge Bjorkman?
Actually, it would be for anyone who cares to answer. But
okay.
Go ahead, Louise, if you want. What you see up there.
Chair Lash, Representative Simon, I am here, I guess, with my civil justice task force hat on to talk about some of the recommendations. I will address your question, and then if I may, I will go more broadly and give people that are not familiar with the task force and what our efforts have been a little bit more background, if I may. Part of the concern identified by the task force was that while our courts are doing an admirable job at getting cases through in a year, uniformly, the courts are respected. People have confidence in the judges. They do a good job. Litigation is too expensive. Discovery in particular. All of the stuff that happens outside of the courtroom once the case is filed takes too long, and it costs way too much money. Too much information being exchanged. Too many people being deposed. And that shows up in court with discovery motions. You saw the stack of stuff that's going to finally perhaps decide a case, or at least is posed with that issue. You should see the stacks of paper that come in because the parties can't agree on what questions should be answered on paper, or what questions a witness should talk about during a deposition, or what information is confidential and what isn't. That's the point at which our litigation system is too expensive. And that's why we find this going to special masters. What the Civil Justice Reform Task Force hopes to accomplish through its recommendations is reducing the amount of discovery in many cases and coordinating it, having courts manage it so it doesn't get to the point where we have to have special masters coming in all the time. And if I may, Chair Lesh, I would just sort of segue into my broader presentation, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Judge Bjorkman, please proceed.
All right. I wanted to talk about basically three issues today. First, the composition of this task force. Secondly, what we identified as the predominant challenges to our civil justice system. And then briefly highlight for you the recommendations and where we're at on those recommendations, which I think is the most exciting thing. As I indicated, it was pretty quick to find out what the challenges were. Again, overall, we're meeting the deadlines, but we're not doing it in a way that is cost-effective for litigants. And so what that means is we are seeing cases that don't come into our civil justice system, that go to arbitration, that go to mediation, and those are not bad things, but it does have an impact. Courts develop the law. Obviously, you pass statutes, but that's only part of the law that governs relationships between parties in civil cases. Part of the law is developed through the courts, through cases, through the individual circumstances that no one piece of legislation can address. And when you don't have cases coming into the courts because it's too expensive to be in court, you're not developing the common law that helps parties govern their contractual relationships and other relationships in the state. That's a big problem. We find too many cases settling, not because they should, not because the merits drive a decision, but because it's just too expensive to be in court. The discovery becomes so prolonged and so costly that it becomes a war of attrition. What we also found And members, many members of the task force, which was a broad group, we had plaintiffs' lawyers, defense lawyers, we had business concerns, people from big corporations in their corporate law departments. We had legal aid lawyers, county attorneys, city attorneys, judges. But what a number of the lawyers, members of the task force said, I regularly have clients come in. They have a $75,000 contract dispute. I have, and they have a good basis to be able to recover that $75,000. But I have to look that client in the eye and say, you know what? I'll take your case. I think it has merits. But I'm just going to tell you, you may well spend more money litigating that case than you're ever going to get out of it. Something's wrong with that. It's an access to justice issue. It should not... We should not be sending people off to arbitration or simply giving up their claims entirely. Or, as we talked about conciliation court, you have people that say, okay, it's a $7,500 conciliation court limit. I know my claim's worth $30,000. I'm going to discount it to stay in conciliation court. It's the only way I'm going to recover. There's something wrong with that. And I was surprised, given the diversity of opinion, given the diversity of practice background, but how united the people on the task force were around the question of, we have got to reduce cost and delay and make our courts more efficient and make our justice, civil justice system, more accessible to the public, to the people that we serve. And another comment about the composition. I'm a child of the prairie. I grew up in Moorhead, Minnesota. It was really important to me that this task force not just be metro area, which I live in the metro. I love the metro. I'm raising my family in the metro. But we're a big state of Minnesota. So... And civil justice challenges are different in Moorhead and Fergus Falls and Duluth than they are in St. Paul, Minnesota. So we had people from all over the state on this task force, and I think that was really helpful in terms of the quality of the product. Anyway, onto some of our recommendations. They are summarized in the two-page document that you received. There are also two big reports. Well, they're not that big. Two reports that were generated, and I think you have the website, link so that you can go there and review the documents. I'm really proud of the reports we generated. I'm even more proud of the fact that there are efforts underway as we speak to implement some of our recommendations. The first one was to reform discovery. We already talked about that discovery is everything that happens before you sit down and try a case. And the premise there is that not all cases are created equal. If you have a simple contract dispute, you should not need a year to get it ready for trial. You should not need to depose five witnesses. You should not need to spend $30,000 exchanging documents. But what do? You have to make sure that each case is handled individually. And so that means you get into court, you have a sit-down with the judge and say, here's the issues in this case, this is what we need to get information about, and these are the issues we think we need to try. And so that the discovery that's permitted in the case, the number of interrogatories, which are the written questions, and the number of depositions, fit the size of the case, the complexity of the case, and make those cases more effective to get ready for trial. Another recommendation is that we do what has been happening in federal court for a number of years, and that is we require parties from the minute a lawsuit is filed to provide the other side automatically, without being asked, sent, you know, a 25-page set of questions, but to provide basic information. What's your claim about? What amount of money are you claiming? Who are your witnesses going to be? Do you have insurance? That kind of basic information that will jumpstart a case, help you get to narrowing the issues when you sit down with the court in the first instance and say, what are we going to do in this case, so you know where you're going and you're focused in the case. Another recommendation is that there be expedited procedures for resolving issues that do arise in discovery, and they still will. There will be questions about whether particular documents are privileged or not. Sometimes you have to have a court make those kind of decisions, but we want those processes to be more expedited rather than reams of paper like this, have a two-page letter brief, maybe followed by a conference call, but make sure that the court can get stuff effectively, and it's, again, not going to bury the parties with paper and cost and delay in the case.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As long as you have pocket filings, aren't you really not getting the case to court before all of those expensive things are happening?
Representative Judge Bjorkman.
Chair Lesh and Representative Hillstrom, one of our other recommendations is that that hip pocket filing be changed. For those of you who aren't lawyers, this is sort of a weird deal. In fact, I spoke at a national institute last fall to present the recommendations of our task force. And people came up to me afterwards like, are you kidding me? People can start a lawsuit in Minnesota simply by serving the other party with a complaint? They don't have to come into court to start a lawsuit? We're one of three states that let parties start their lawsuits by service. There are, you know, and there are competing considerations on that point. There are some cases that are best handled out of the limelight, whether it's an employment dispute that involves confidential information, if it's an antitrust case that has copyright, patent, those kind of things. There are certain circumstances where it makes sense to allow parties to litigate privately. There are, you know, people that can save the filing fee in a case that's going to be resolved easily. But people on the task force, and not just the judges, but the party, but lawyers and other members of the community, also agreed that when a party is using the authority of the courts to seek recovery, court ought to be able to manage that case. And if a case is out in this shadow litigation for 3 or 4 years and it's lots of parties, they get so entrenched that their disputes are more difficult for the courts to resolve, and more importantly, the courts haven't had a chance to try to manage the case in a way that's more cost-effective for the parties. So one of the recommendations from the task force is that people get to still start the lawsuit by just serving it, but that within a year they have to file it with the court. So if it's not settled in that year, you come into court, you meet with the judge, you start getting some judicial management, get some trial deadlines put in place. So that's the recommendation that the task force has made to the Supreme Court, that it be altered in some way to preserve the positive sides, if you will, but require parties to come into court. And having said that, and I always forget to say this, just because the person who initiates the lawsuit doesn't choose to file it doesn't mean the defendant can't at any time say, I'm bringing it into court because I'm not answering that discovery. I mean, so there's always that backdrop. So in some respects, this maybe isn't the biggest driver of cost and delay, but it certainly can be, and I think the most important thing is that if a case has been out there for 3-4 years, it makes it very difficult for the court to then step in and give you a trial date next week or manage the case.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you. As a follow-up to that, so you said that you've recommended that to the Supreme Court. So is that something that the Supreme Court can do on their own, or is that something that would require legislation?
Judge Bjorkman.
As I understand it, that is a rule that the Supreme Court would be able to change.
And maybe House Research could answer this, Representative Hillstrom, but the legislature typically has jurisdiction over substantive matters before the court, and the Supreme Court has jurisdiction over procedural matters. Now, I can't remember. You're closer to law school than I was, but the case law that says that process is substance. So it the lines are blurred there substantially. Could House Research help out? Okay. I guess I'm right.
All right.
Well, you know, I'm chair. Judge Bjorkman.
Chair Lesh, some other of the key recommendations. One is to handle complex civil cases more effectively. These are cases that we lose. I talk about the judicial branch. We lose to arbitration and mediation. Typically, when I talk about a complex case, it's one that has either a lot of parties, complex legal issues, numerous witnesses, lots of, in a case that we don't lose, lots of, you know, there might be injunctions and things the court would have to manage after a trial or after a resolution. And those cases can be very difficult, particularly when you get in outside of Hennepin and Ramsey County where civil cases are blocked. And I'm glad they talked about blocking. The task force also recommends that, as part of a best practice, that all civil cases be blocked in the state of Minnesota. And by that I mean that a particular case be assigned to a particular judge from cradle to grave, because that is the most efficient way from the party's perspective to handle a case. In terms of, and we certainly believe that's a best practice, and how that will play out per district, you know, I'm not sure, and people above my pay grade have to decide that. I'm not going to tell one particular district how they have to manage their cases, because there are different efficiencies that are achieved in different ways. But in terms of the complex cases, the recommendation is that our rules of procedure be revised so that those cases are assigned to a specific judge from cradle to grave. that they have an initial case management conference right away when the parties all sit down together and plan out what are the issues that are going to be addressed, what's our timeline, that they be given a firm trial date right then at the first conference. Studies have shown that having a particular judge block to a case and establishing a firm trial deadline are the most important factors in reducing cost to the litigants and delay in getting to trial. And so those are very important, particularly with these complex cases. The other thing that we're recommending is that the judges who take on these complex cases receive special training. As Judge Vandenorth indicated, when both he and I joined the Ramsey County bench, we came from civil practice. And so in my years where I was handling civil cases there, I thought, well, I know what I'm doing here because this is what I did. But these complex cases, I'm telling you, when you have lots of parties and there's insurance issues and there's all this other kinds of stuff, it's a unique skill set, and we can all use training on how to handle those more effectively. So training of judges to handle those cases is an essential component of that. Kind of the flip side of those complex cases is our recommendation that the Supreme Court conduct a pilot. And, you know, this has gotten different names. Some people call expedited litigation the rocket docket. And we've taken runs at the rocket docket in Minnesota before, and other states have done it as well. But we're recommending that there be a pilot in two counties, one in greater Minnesota, one in the metro area, that will provide people that have smaller claims. And the task force defines small claims, and this is a shock to me, as $100,000 or less. I mean, $100,000 is a lot of money, I think, but, you know, again, that was sort of the cutoff point where a number of the lawyers said, you know what, at $100,000 is where I tell my client it ain't worth pursuing. You're going to spend $100,000 to get $100,000 back. And so we thought there's got to be a way to give people who have a $100,000 claim their day in court in a cost-effective way. We think it can be done with an expedited litigation track, where, again, it's a specific judge assigned, very limited discovery. I mean, I'm talking one deposition. I'm talking 15 written requests for information. And you get a firm trial date 4 to 6 months out. I mean, the longer a case is around, the more expensive it is for the parties. And so we're recommending that these pilots be conducted to see if that's something that would work overall in these cases. In terms, you know, other things we recommended was the hip pocket I've talked about. The task force also favored supporting a legislative initiative to increase the conciliation court limit. Again, we viewed that as an access to justice issue for litigants, and we were pleased that the legislature, in fact, did that last year. At this point, you're wondering, okay, what's going on with these reports? There was a public hearing in late October of last year. I expect that we're going to be getting an order from the Supreme Court on the recommendations within the next 30 days. I know that the two pilot counties, St. Louis County, which is Duluth, as you know, and Dakota County, have been selected to do the pilot of the fast track, you know, quick litigation thing. And I understand that rules are being developed to address some of the other recommendations. So I'm very excited about the work the task force did. I am glad that it has gone beyond simply putting reports together. I truly believe that the Minnesota Supreme Court is poised to make transformative changes, and that we really will make good on our promise to provide all civil litigants a form for the just, speedy, and inexpensive determination of their disputes.
Thank you, Judge Bjork. And Representative Scott?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just, Judge, in light of what Chair explained to us about who's responsible for what and whatever. Is there anything, I guess, that the legislature can do to help bring about these reforms? Do you see anything on the horizon and through your task force that would say, yeah, this is something that could be done legislatively to help us?
Judge Gorkin.
Chairman Lesh and Representative Scott, I mean, the primary thing that we were turning to the legislature for has already been accomplished, and that the conciliation court limits have been increased. And I would just say that, you know, your general ongoing support for the efforts of the judicial branch, and you have been so supportive of all of the efforts to use technology to be more efficient, to expand programs, to focus judicial resources in areas that the courts believe make for better justice and more effective justice. And so I would just ask, you know, continued support to the branch in these efforts. Thank you.
I'd ask members to please turn off your cell phones if they're not off. Representative Simon, I'm sorry, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've noticed that in criminal court that things like interpreters have been more necessary. Do you find that in civil litigation that you end up needing additional interpreters and things of that nature?
Judge Vandenorth.
Chairman Lesch and Representative Hillstrom, more and more all the time. This is clearly, Representative Liebling, a demographics issue. That community that we live in and that sends people to court looks a lot different than it did when I started out. It certainly adds costs and delays, but it's worth it. And we provide these services, and we're able to get through this, but it's a challenge. But to answer your question, I see it on the rise in civil.
Mr. Chair.
Well, Judge Bjorkman and then Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you. Well, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to then ask a follow-up to that is, so as more and more of these cases end up in conciliation court for larger and larger amounts, how are you dealing with the need for additional interpreters with larger and larger cases in this smaller court?
Judge Warner.
If I may, Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, we're providing the services to the expense of the judicial district. Just as an example, several years ago, I had an 8-day civil trial that was American Sign Language interpreted. We, as a judicial district, had to pay for the two interpreters because they took turns, 20 minutes at a time. We paid for those interpreters. So it's added expense to the judicial district.
Judge Bjorkman.
Thank you, Chairman Lesch. I forget all of the recommendations sometimes that the task force made. One of them, the lawyers in the group right now, you file an informational statement when you submit your complaint or your answer with the district court. And basically that is just sort of information about who are the lawyers, who are the parties, what's your address, what's your email. One of the recommendations of the task force is that we sort of get up with the times about what information do the courts really need to handle a case efficiently. And so we're recommending that a different form, a civil cover sheet, be utilized. And one of the pieces of information requested is there a need for an interpreter, so that the court can know that right away, and so that when the first hearing is scheduled, that need will be met.
Thank you. Representative Simon.
Just a quick question about alternative dispute resolution. You mentioned losing cases to things like arbitration, sort of pre-filing, people who go that route rather than within the court. But as you know, there's a strong ADR, or alternative dispute resolution, process within the state courts, too. It's mandatory. So that's another way, I guess you might say, you lose cases in the sense that they're not helping create the body of law in a particular area. Is the ADR system working, or does that need tweaks as well? And maybe that was beyond the purview of your work, but is it working?
Judge Bjorkman.
Chairman Lesch and Representative Simon, you are correct in pointing out a difference between court-ordered ADR, which is part of our process, and, you know, there is something to be said for settling disputes when the merits suggest that a settlement is appropriate. And so I would expect that the ADR processes that the court directs would continue. I think they are effective. I expect that when you have an expedited case that's going to go in 4 to 6 months, that you probably won't do arbitration on those kinds of cases. But certainly there is still merit to resolving cases. And we have a number of good providers of ADR services. So the task force was not seeking to eliminate ADR as part of the court-provided services.
Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And well, first, just a real quick comment about conciliation court, which has been mentioned a number of times. And I have to tell you that one of the judges in my local area has been adamantly opposed to raising the limits. And I think it's because she feels that what we're doing is pushing more complex matters into this simpler procedure as we raise these monetary limits, and that's to the disadvantage of the people who are often the pro se litigant, who just don't have the protections. And and often end up on the short end of the stick. So I just wanted to put that out there because it's not an unmitigated, wonderful, uncontroversial matter to keep raising those limits. But what I wanted to ask about is this idea of having one judge, so-called, from cradle to grave, and that is, I think, a very good idea in many cases, but it does bring up an issue, I think, especially in family court, something that has been discussed quite a bit, is that what happens when one party feels very strongly that judge is biased against their matter? Are they stuck? Is there a removal process? Is there any safety valve for that person? Because I think we all know that obviously the court is resolves things, and oftentimes somebody leaves unhappy. That's just the nature of the beast. But of course, we all want that person to leave feeling they had justice, even if they didn't get their, even if they didn't win, so-called. So what do we do in the case where somebody just feels that judge just formed an opinion about me, and he or she is not going to change their opinion, and I am just going to lose if we stay in front of this judge?
Who wants to take that? Judge Vandenorth?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, I'll start out. Everybody has sort of one free bite early on to get rid of the judge. Once you're notified of the judge assigned to your case, within, I think it's 10 days, you can have a judge removed for no cause at all. You just have a free ability to have a judge removed. Of course, you don't know who you're going to get in replace, so you better be darn sure that this person is somebody you really want off the case. Once the case gets going, and the judge demonstrates what you think is some sort of bias or prejudice, there is a process for removing the judge for bias or prejudice. It's a high standard. It's difficult to get it done. And, of course, judges don't like to be called prejudice or bias, so we resist that a little bit as well. But it can be done. So if I'm asked to remove myself for bias and I say, no way, I'm not biased, you can then appeal that determination from me to this lady right here. And the chief gets those appeals from the individual judges. She's a little bit more removed from all of it and looks at all the facts, and the chief can remove a judge and replace it. Doesn't happen very often, but it can.
Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you. And I mostly practice in criminal court, and I know you could do that in criminal court. So, but I would respectfully suggest that if we're really going to a system when one judge keeps a case, that's not a totally adequate remedy because of that high standard, and because it's often a perception issue and not an issue where somebody's going to objectively find that there's bias, and because it is a high standard that judges do feel defensive about it. And I would just suggest that there may be a place for a lower standard just because of the perception that you want people to feel that they are getting a fair hearing, even though you may feel that they already are.
I would add also, Your Honors, that many members of this committee practice primarily in the criminal area, and it's tempting to conflate sometimes criminal standards with what are civil standards, so it might be a good opportunity, this being the Civil Law Committee, especially for those who are non-attorneys. What is the fundamental difference between the civil law system and the criminal law system?
Mr. Chair, if I
Judge Warner.
The fundamental difference to start out with is in civil, you're talking primarily about money. In criminal, you're talking about different effect on people's lives, and that's time. What I think is civil, so that's the biggest difference in the civil and criminal. There's time differences as well. A speedy trial request in criminal, I mean, you can have a felony case. I'm supposed to have a pretrial on homicide this morning. If that defendant today requests a speedy trial, I'll have that case tried in 60 days. It'll be done in 60 days. That's a little different than the timelines on civil cases where you're talking about a year. But the process is different. There's different rules in criminal regarding discovery. There's not depositions. For instance, Judge Bjorkman talks about the discovery process in a civil case. In a criminal case, the rules are completely different. Discovery is open. You've got police reports, you've got interviews, you've got investigation. You give that to the other party. There's no Interrogatories, you don't ask questions. Discovery is pretty open. So those are the fundamental differences.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the only thing I would add in addition, there's no constitutional right to an attorney in a civil case. You're guaranteed by decisions of our U.S. Supreme Court to have a lawyer appointed for you if you cannot afford one in a criminal case to defend yourself. And this extends all the way down to the misdemeanor level. And I've always thought it's sort of anomalous that you are not entitled to have a lawyer when somebody is talking about taking your child away from you, but you are entitled to have a lawyer when somebody's talking about driving without a license. Seems anomalous to me.
Understood. Thank you. And to be sensitive to the judge's time, who I think have other places to be this morning, I really want to thank you for being here. It was very informative. I think members got a lot out of it. And we have a lot more to do, especially I think in the area of family law, as was suggested by Representative Hortman, that that we have a separate discussion on family law and the procedures involved therein. But, Your Honors, thank you very much for your attendance and being here. The members, thank you. With no other business before the... What's that? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In regard to Friday, what will we be hearing on Friday morning? What will be the discussion topic?
Can I say that, or is that a big secret? We published it, didn't we? Oh, okay, yeah, it's going to be the health care exchange bill.
In light of that, I know that there are going to be a couple of hearings on that in GovOps, I think, today and possibly tomorrow, and the schedule says it may go on into tomorrow evening. And in light of our 24-hour rule on amendments, and the fact that probably not till Thursday afternoon would there be an engrossment from any of those, amendments that might happen, that's not going to allow us enough time for the 24-hour rule. So I'm just wondering what you might want to do there. Maybe push it to Monday. I know we have some conflicts.
Well, we have the hearing on Friday. Did you have something you want to say? Okay, forget it. We have the hearing on Friday. I may bend the amendment rule on that just because of the nature of these things.
Yeah.
But I want to wait until we see whether or not it doesn't come out till Thursday night before we do that. I would add, so we're just hearing it on the data practices portion, Representative Scott. Right. And that's my intention, just because of how much there is in data practices on this, it'll take up all the committee time on it.
I guess my second question then would be, is the data practices subcommittee going to have a meeting before Friday then to talk about that, or are you just planning on taking that up with the full committee?
Full committee will be taking this one up.
Okay. Just my concern is that the public and ourselves would have adequate time to look at any amendments that might affect.
Understood. Well, I don't anticipate, Representative Scott, that the other committees that see it before us are going to be talk. They shouldn't be talking about the data practices portion. They should be only be talking about their areas. So if you have amendments regarding data practices, the form of the bill should be intact when it arrives at us with related to those data practices provisions. I do not anticipate any changes. If there were, I imagine someone would tell me, because I'd be very surprised.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Thank you, Your Honors. Committee is adjourned.
Thank you.